This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield.
It's so surreal when I was talking to my wife, and I'm like, babe, we did it. Like...
That's LeBron James speaking Wednesday at the Cleveland Cavaliers Championship Parade. The Championship Parade in Cleveland. More on that to come on Three Stories You Should Know. My guests are sports writer Eric Malinowski and ESPN The Magazine's Mina Kimes, both joining me by Skype. Welcome back.
Hello.
Thanks, Bill.
Eric, you have covered the NBA Finals. We might as well give this to you to begin.
Yes. Yeah, so as you said, the NBA Finals went to their farthest, most dramatic conclusion possible. And in the end, it was Cleveland. Yes, Cleveland that was able to
top. That's four times we've said
that
now.
It's incredible. You can't say it enough. It's so unbelievable. LeBron James was, as we've all saw, quite superhuman from games 5 through 7. But he also got the help he needed. You know, Kyrie Irving hit the game-winning shot over Steph Curry. And Kevin Love then defended Steph Curry marvelously, you could say, in those waning seconds. And I wonder how this changes our perception of the city of Cleveland going forward. I mean, you could say that so much of their identity has been wrapped, you know, for, say, 5 decades in this, you know, kind of defeatism. But, you know, I was at the Quicken Loans Arena for game 6 of the finals, and they were down 3-2 going into that night. And I have never seen a group of people more ready for a party. So, you know, even if we, the non-Cavs rooting public, may have trouble coming to grips with this new reality, I would say that the Clevelanders have embraced it full on pretty quickly.
Yeah, you know, I feel like I can really relate to Cleveland insofar as I'm a Seattle sports fan. And until recently, I think we were up for the title of most miserable city in sports. You know, the NBA team hadn't won a championship since 1979 and then went away and left the city. The Mariners teams in the 90s and early 2000s were great, but never won. Still haven't been to the playoffs in over a decade now. And the Seahawks were good, but they came so close and lost. And then Super Bowl 48 happened. So people always ask me if I was completely emotionally wrecked by 49. And I really wasn't, I say as I shudder uncontrollably thinking about the ending. Because once you win a championship, you get this kind of weird halo effect that lasts for a few years. So now I would say it's, you know, Buffalo, Atlanta, San Diego, definitely not Cleveland.
I'm going to have to impose a little bit of perspective on this. And I realize as a host of a sports show, this is an odd role for me to play. But, you know, the river no longer catches on fire in Cleveland. That, to me, was the turning point when things got okay for Cleveland. Seattle has great coffee. It has a wonderful bookstore. It's a really nice place, whether or not the sports teams win.
Well, that's why I always feel so weird putting San Diego in the group, you know, with Buffalo, because maybe on a sports level, they're equally sad. But, you know, one of those places is a little grimmer than the
other. I know
other.
Which one I would prefer to visit if given my brothers.
Mina, you've been following the scandal regarding Russia and the 2016 Olympics. Catch us up on that, because things seem to be changing by the hour.
Yeah, so for those who haven't been paying attention over the last year or so, there's been a number of exposés and investigations revealing that there's been systematic and possibly government-sanctioned doping in Russian sports. In November, the International Association of Athletics Federations, which governs track and field, suspended the Russian team. They confirmed that suspension for the Olympics last week. However, the IOC has suggested that some athletes can get around the suspension. And now the latest thing is the IOC, which has been historically somewhat cozy with Russia and Putin on this, has said that athletes who do get around it can walk, you know, out under the Russian flag. The IAAF has said they need to be neutral. So this seems like a symbolic issue, but actually I think it really cuts to the heart of the scandal, which is, in my view, and I think the view of a lot of athletes who have lost unfairly to Russian athletes over the years, the IOC needs to punish not only individual athletes, but also the country.
You know, even just from sort of like a 30,000-foot view, the idea that we're now, what are we, like less than 6 weeks away from the start of the Olympics, and the IOC is still sort of defining which athletes would theoretically be able to compete and under the banner of which flag. I mean, it kind of feels like FIFA level incompetence, which, you know, as we all know, that's an impressively high bar. But kudos to them for reaching for their dreams, you know. But at the same time, I mean, you know, these are the Olympics here. So, I mean, how surprised could we possibly be at this?
Well, perhaps not surprised. You may be right. My feeling is if Russian athletes compete under the Russian flag, the whole business about banning cheaters is going to be revealed as a sham. If there are any Russian athletes who really can prove they didn't participate in this state doping program and those athletes compete under the Olympic flag, I would applaud because I think that might be a step toward eliminating national flags from the games and moving toward a system where the competition was focused on individual athletic performances rather than on flag waving. But that's probably a reach from this current circumstance. I don't know.
Oh, well, I still want the international flag. I mean, that's the great fun of it, right, is these sort of countries coming together and watching and rooting for their flags and their countrymen. But, you know, I agree. Like, if they let them walk out under the Russian flag, that basically undermines the entire punishment because what they've been doing is so systematic. It's not individual athletes. It's not a few bad apples. Mm-hmm. The revelations have just been so incredible that I think it really will take something dramatic to make change.
I know you're both going to be shocked to hear this, but I've been paying attention to soccer. And for some soccer, for some soccer fans, the first Copa America soccer tournament hosted here in the U.S. has been going on in the shadow of the European championships going on in France. Not for me. I really have enjoyed seeing some of the world's best players here in the U.S. while they still are at their best, young enough to be at the top of their game. And I think the tournament has taught soccer fans something about their home team here in the U.S. The squad under Jurgen Klinsmann beat three good teams. Then they lost to a couple that were better than good. But still, am I being unreasonably positive to say the Copa results should inspire improvement rather than provoke despair among American soccer fans? Eric?
No. I mean, I think, like most red-blooded beer-drinking Americans, I was pretty pumped for that Argentina match. I was excited. And then, boy, howdy, that was a really fun 2 minutes before it all pretty much went to hell. But this was a reality check. And I would say that, you know, maybe this is my recency bias from the NBA Finals creeping in. But, you know, I do think that losing is a lot more educational than winning. Jurgen Klinsmann has stated this goal publicly that he wants, you know, assuming he's around in 2 years, but he wants the men's national team to reach the semifinals of the World Cup in 2018. But they have a long ways to go. And I think that this was a good reminder of that.
I struggle with optimism here, mainly because, you know, so few of the players are young. I think only maybe three of the starters were in their early 20s or younger. And then, as we've seen in the U.S., the under 20 team hasn't done super well. The under 23 team failed to qualify for the Olympics. So moving forward, it's like, what does the future look like if there aren't young stars sort of rising to take the reins?
No problem. We'll just all watch the women's team because they always win. Anyway, my guests for Three Stories You Should Know have been sports writer Eric Malinowski and ESPN The Magazine's Mina Kimes. Thank you both very much.
Thank you.
Thanks, Bill.
Lionel Messi, for whom those fans are shouting, may be the world's best soccer player. Argentina, his team, may be the world's best national side. Late last week, while Argentina practiced before their Copa America quarterfinal game against Venezuela, I was moved to undertake a quest. It happened while I was watching the team practice in the company of many from behind a fence draped with green mesh.
Are we allowed to, like, climb up a little bit?
Spanish was spoken here a lot, but had any of the people speaking it come all the way from Argentina to this humble practice field next to the Harvard Business School just to see their team? It was a burning question, or an excuse to talk with lots of soccer fans. Let's go with burning question, also with quest.
We used to live in Caracas for many years, and we moved recently to the U.S.
That guy identified himself as Juan Sr. Nice guy, but Caracas is in Venezuela, so I was 0-1. Though Juan Jr., perched on Juan Sr.'s shoulders, wasn't going to let his country of origin diminish his determination to at least imagine that he could see Leo Messi.
It's right here, he's shooting the ball. Like, he's not, like, far away, he's right here.
A little further along the grassy slope where everyone was standing, a fellow in a Barcelona cap was singing the praises of the crowd's favorite.
Este por Messi.
It's Messi, he says, on the Argentina side, the best in the world.
Number one.
Sin duda.
Oh, claro que sí.
He turned out to be from Honduras, 0-for-2. So I moved on to speak with a woman in an Argentina jersey with Messi's number on the back.
I want to watch Messi. He's very famous and he plays in a very good team.
You mean Argentina or Barcelona?
But.
That's Lillian Marr. She's from Mexico and Salvador, neither of which is Argentina. And so the quest, in which I was now 0-for-3, went on until I found Belin.
Yes.
Are you from Argentina?
I'm from Argentina. I'm on vacation here.
But was Belin vacationing here because the team from her country was playing here? Because otherwise it wouldn't count.
No, because my sister lives here.
Oh, so close. And close would have been all I could manage in the search for an actual Argentinian who'd come to Massachusetts to see Messi if I hadn't noticed one more woman in one of those blue and white jerseys. She was peeking through a tear in the green mesh. But it would only happen if I'd risk making a fool of myself by relying on Spanish, because Paula, my last hope, spoke no English.
¿Por qué está aquí?
Vine de vacaciones.
She had planned her vacation to coincide with her team's appearance in the tournament, but had she come to the U.S. specifically to see her team play?
Aquí para la selección, para el partido?
Sí.
Oh, sí?
Mm-hmm.
Bueno.
Yeah.
Perfecto. Gracias.
Muchas gracias.
She was here, now, for that reason. So gracias indeed, for my burning question had been answered yes, or sí, actually. And just in time, the gates in that fence were opening so media members could enter to watch the final minutes of Team Argentina at play. Perhaps Paula traveled to Houston to see Argentina in the Copa America semifinal on Tuesday, or maybe she watched it on TV from Massachusetts. In either case, she must have been delighted. Her team handily beat the U.S. 4-0. The Copa America final will match Argentina against Chile on Sunday night. I'm Bill Littlefield. In Glasgow, Scotland, 2 months ago, a 42-year-old boxer from Liverpool, England, fought for the WBF Cruiserweight World title. Tony Moran's journey to that match took him through a karate dojo, a mixed martial arts cage, and a homeless center. He tells his story now in his own words.
I had this fierce desire to make something of my life. Not for egotistical reasons, I don't mean it like that. Because I could see how unhappy my parents were, and I had this feeling that I needed to do something to help them as well. I lived in quite a rough neighbourhood. Not a lot of life opportunities, so to speak. If I was lucky, I would have ended up in a very menial job, earning a very menial wage, and not having much of a life to look forward to. I wasn't a kid who was fighting on the streets. I wasn't a rough and ready type kid. I was just a gentle, nice guy. Then I went into a karate dojo at the age of 13 and found out that I had a skill for fighting. And I held on to it with dear life. I never let go. I just knew intuitively it was going to lead somewhere better than where I was, because where I was nowhere. I realised I had a lot of power in my techniques, even though I was a skinny, tall kid. Within a year, I won my first British karate title. I defended it every year consecutively from the age of 14 to 26, and I never lost it once. That's not bad for a boy who didn't know how to fight in the beginning. I didn't take up boxing until I was 28 years of age. Karate and boxing are very different in terms of the sport and context. But I just knew I could fight, and I knew I had a gift for fighting. And I wanted to take that onto a bigger stage, and in my mind, boxing was the next big stage. I virtually got laughed out of every boxing gym, boxing manager's office, promoter, coach. No one would take me seriously. I used to work 3 jobs. I was putting in, on average, 80 to 100-hour weeks. I was running a martial arts club myself. I was working security on nightclubs. I was working in homeless centres. I would go to a night shift. I would deal with some really difficult situations, violent situations, stressful situations throughout that night. Then I would have to go to the gym, maybe spar with a high-level professional. Then I'd engage in the gym work that was necessary to be prepared for fights. Then I'd maybe get a little bit of sleep, a few hours here, a few hours there, go for a run and repeat the process, like Groundhog Day. Within 2 years, I was fighting for the British and Commonwealth titles, ranked in the top 10 in the UK. I fought for the world title 2006, that would have been. And after the fought for that world title and I lost, I thought, I'm having a child now. This is probably too much now. So I decided at that point to stop the boxing. I was 34. And then after a few months after the baby was born, I started getting bored. So I decided to go to a gym called the Wolf's Lair, which is quite a famous MMA gym close to Liverpool. I just wanted to learn stuff. I didn't want to fight again in my mind at that point. But after developing so well and so quickly there and seeing people earn a lot of money in the UFC and stuff, I started realising I could have a future in that also. Started competing, started going fantastically well, but I wasn't respectful of the fact that my life was still even more difficult than it was because now I had children to contend with as well as the three jobs and as well as a fight, yeah. It caused probably relationship problems, it caused problems within my own sort of stress levels and I just had no, I had just something inside that wouldn't allow me to stop. The reason for me being homeless is one of simple economics. I'd suffered a breakup 3 years ago. I can't afford to run two homes on one wage. I still see my place as the provider. So I'm providing all the same resources, but I just couldn't live in that home. I was in work Christmas Day doing a shift, and I had nowhere to go that night because it was Christmas night. I didn't want to intrude on other people's family time. So that first night was the first night that I stayed in strange surroundings. When I say strange surroundings, it was my workplace, but it was the laundry room of my workplace. And I had nowhere else to go, effectively. And I had to go down the stairs and basically sleep on the laundry room floor Christmas night. Thinking back now, it wasn't good. It wasn't good at all. I was in this dark place thinking, wow, how's this happened? How have I ended up here? I've worked so hard to get out of this. And now I've ended up in the worst position I've ever been in. It was quite shocking at the time. Yeah, I wasn't even thinking about fighting at the time. I was lost in my own drama and my own stress and my own worries and my own everything. I was just lost due to that breakup. I'm suffering then quite badly with depression and stuff like that. And I realised that I had to get back to the old me, and fighting was what all I knew. And that was something positive in my life, so I dusted off the cobwebs and took a fight against a very high-level opponent. When I got to that fight, which was very proud of myself for actually getting back, I got my skull fractured in the cage during the fight. A bit like Million Dollar Baby, but in an MMA cage. And then I went on a deeper decline into depression after that, because the thing I love most, which what I was holding on to, is my only life belt, had been taken away. Got a beautiful partner in my life now who helped me get out just through love and through care and through attention. And then I found health. I found my health, which is the most abundant thing I've ever found. I was always fit. I've been super fit all my life, but I was never healthy. I started getting healthy. I started getting my vitality back. I started getting my energy back. I started getting my zest for life and competition back. So I went to a friend's gym. I've known this man a long time. I didn't know he was coaching fighters, but it turns out he was an old friend, but it turns out he was also an amazing coach of boxing. And he started giving me tips and giving me tutelage on the correct formula for boxing skill. And he started to develop me in the gym. There was no intention to fight at the time again. But I started realising that this man was the missing link in my fight career. I'd never had a coach who stood by me. Within 2 years, it took me from a virtual novice who was fighting for major titles to a skilled fighter fighting for major titles and winning them. The week of the fight, the world title fight, I was staying in a guy's apartment temporarily, and I was working on a nightclub in the city centre of Liverpool, and I got two calls within an hour on the Wednesday before the fight. The fight was on a Saturday. I got told my accommodation was finished and my job was over. So I had to deal with those sort of issues. But no, I went in there with total and utter determination to win. And I won the fight. I won the fight convincingly, and even the judges had to score it convincingly because it was so clear. The belt was the thing that cemented the journey. it's opened doors for me, and I've established a new life as a personal trainer, and it's the best thing I've ever done, I think. It's a good story for people to listen to because it's triumphed through adversity. Now I'm with the partner that I love going forward in life, looking to get a home in the near future. I can't wait. I'm desperate for my own base now, my own cupboard to put my own clothes in, my own cupboard to put my own food in. I'm seeing my kids regular. Life's good. I'm happy. I'm moving forward in the most abundance of ways, and it's great. I'm loving life. I hope you can hear it in my voice.
Tony Moran is now running a personal training service for children and adults in Liverpool. He has no more fights scheduled, but he's not ruling out the possibility of a return to the ring. Our story was produced by Martin Kessler. If you haven't already, subscribe to Only a Game on iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever you get your podcasts, and write us a review. You can also share your thoughts about this week's show on Facebook and Twitter at Only a Game NPR. In the summer of 2007, a man set out on a record-breaking journey. It was something the then 54-year-old had dreamed of doing for decades, but it wasn't until tragedy struck that he finally decided to begin. Journalist Alex Ashley has our story.
So, 900 strokes per nautical mile.
I'm sitting in a busy pub in Bellingham, Washington. Beside me, nursing a beer, is a former engineer turned world traveler. He's doing math on the back of a napkin.
261 plus 123450.
Easier than most people balance their checkbooks, my dinner companion is adding up the number of strokes it took to row around the world.
26 million strokes. Nah, give or take. A million.
My name is Ardan Eruç. I've been a traveler and adventurer since 2002.
To tell Ardan Eruç's story, we have to rewind back to the moment it went from ordinary to extraordinary at a rock formation in Washington State, a place called Frenchman Coulee.
It was getting to be chilly and cloudy. It was a cold September day.
The date was September 30th, 2002. Ardan was on a climbing trip with his close friend and mentor, Swedish adventurer and mountaineer Göran Kropp.
We were high-fiving, talking about what we would do in the future together. Chalk flying in the air as we slapped hands.
Göran had done all the things Ardan wanted to do. In 1996, he bicycled from Sweden to Mount Everest, climbed the mountain by himself without oxygen, and then wrote a book about it.
And once I read this, I said, oh, this is a man close to my heart.
Ardan had been planning to circumnavigate the globe, but he never seemed to be able to get started.
I had never taken the first real step toward the journey of 1,000 steps, if you will.
The climb at Frenchman Coulee that Göran and Ardan were attempting that day in 2002 wasn't particularly difficult, just a fun route for climbers to keep their belaying skills sharp. Ardan's wife, Nancy, got the phone call from a hospital emergency room.
I started to shake. I remember that. And then I heard his voice in the distance. He said that, yes, there was an accident, that Göran fell.
We don't know why he fell. We only know that his system failed, and he didn't come to a stop until he hit my ledge, then fell off onto the path below. All I could do at that time was to decide, okay, it was his time to go.
This person who was larger than life in our lives falls to his death on his watch, on his belay. And even as I recall it now, I can feel the emotion of that day. And that actually was the catalyst that put this entire dream into motion.
Life was passing me by. I had to get going. So quickly, I made a decision coming back from his funeral.
It was on the way back.
I drew the world map on the
proverbial napkin
and marked the highest summits on each continent except Antarctica. And I said, I'm going to go around the world.
And dedicate that to Göran.
Ardan would attempt a circumnavigation of the globe using only human power, climbing the six summits along the way. To reach each major summit, he'd have to accomplish something unprecedented, rowing across the oceans, all of them.
He couldn't just talk about it anymore.
She said, you have to do this now.
Erdan reached out for funding, including to Euron's former sponsors, and he got nothing, not even a response. But he didn't give up.
We cashed out my 401k, and then we downsized our home. We had a condo facing Lake Union. We sold that and then moved away from downtown Seattle so that we could live on one salary.
It is just short of 6:30, and it is the 10th of July, Tuesday morning.
Aboard a small one-man vessel with enough space to either row or sleep, Erdan left Bodega Bay, California quietly.
This is it. Finally, the time is here.
Erdan brought along equipment to document his journey. He plans to turn his footage into a film someday. Day after day, Erdan pushed further and further from land.
I am pretty much due west of Bodega Bay. It's wonderful progress. I can boogie down south. I'm happy. I'm not seasick either.
Days turned into weeks. Weeks became months.
Day 100 is not any different than day 101 after a while. I was able to turn inward and enjoy the challenge.
Today is November 9, and I am absolutely frustrated.
Of course, not all the challenges were enjoyable.
What the hell is going on? There must be an eddy or something that is catching my boat and just carrying it north right now.
Well, Erdan was fighting the elements, braving the oceans, cycling across continents, climbing mountains. His wife was patiently bearing the load of his absence and watching their bank account slowly dwindling.
It felt like it was spiraling out of control.
I could have gotten myself all caught up in he's gone and I'm by myself and all of that, but that's no way to live.
I had committed all my resources, all my relationships, all my time to this journey. We were bleeding money. I had received no coverage, no support, no sponsorship, and finishing it was going to be the only saving grace in this.
On July 21st, 2012, Erdan arrived at a starting point in Bodega Bay.
The journey is coming to a close. The journey's coming to a close!
It took Erdan 5 years and 11 days to complete the journey. He set so many world records, he can't even remember them all. First solo circumnavigation by human power. Most miles rowed. Longest time spent at sea for a solo rower, 312 days. The list goes on, Erdan says. He hasn't been able to climb all six peaks yet. He still has three to go. He says money is the issue. But he made it from point A back to point A, and he's the only guy ever to do it successfully without a sail or an engine to help him.
And once I got to the finish line, I realized I had been gone for so long that everybody had moved on. Children of my friends had grown up. They had new lives. I think it was harder than the journey itself.
So it's been 3 years now that he's been off the expedition, and sometimes I would look at him and I'd say, where are you? Are you on expedition? And in his mind, he was. But I can usually tell by the look on his face or, you know, he's glancing off into the distance that he's really out on the ocean.
I can define myself around the journey. I can become the journey. I am that person now, a nomad, a transient.
After years of dreaming, it took the death of his friend, climber Euron Krop, for Erdan Aruk to finally begin his own adventure. But now that he's home, it's the oceans, not the mountains, that are calling him back.
I find myself wanting to get on a journey again. That's part of my struggle. And Nancy knows that. She's not going to stop me if I want to get on an ocean again.
Well, what are you going to do? You going to try to hold him down? You going to try to hold him back? I mean, I like it all the time, but I'm going to be okay.
Of course, we're making the best of the time together that we have.
For Only a Game, I'm Alex Ashley.
We'll be right back with Charlie Pierce and more sports NPR style next week on the show.
I'm 60 years old now. Time just flew by. And before you know it, it's all over and done. it's hard for me to look back on my career now because it's so painful. I had it all in the palm of my hand, and I let it slip away.
That's former NBA player Billy Ray Bates, who shares his story of a basketball dream cut short. I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, the story of a retired pitcher who went to court to fight a beer company. But first, I'm joined by Charlie Pierce for our look at the week's news. Hello, Charlie.
Hey, Bill.
Since we last spoke, LeBron James and the Cleveland Cavaliers have become champions of the NBA. So, greatest basketball comeback ever?
Great one. No question. Final validation of LeBron James as one of the two or three best basketball players who ever lived. All kinds of good stuff. And an absolute sartorial revolution.
Yes, absolutely. Speaking of which, in a conversation with the Cleveland head coach, the president of the United States has weighed in on Cleveland's post-championship fashion choices, many of which involve a shirtless J.R. Smith. I'm going to let Mr. Obama speak for himself on this one.
Tell J.R. and everybody to put on a shirt, though.
Okay, I will. I definitely will.
You can't be just walking around without a shirt for life.
Okay, I definitely
like
will.
Like a whole week.
Do you side with the chief executive on this sartorial matter?
You don't have to run again. Lighten up, Mr. President. J.R. Smith has literally not worn a shirt since the last game of the NBA Finals ended. And I'm not entirely sure he's ever going to put one on again.
Charlie, all draft nights are ballyhooed, of course. None more than the NBA draft night, which, of course, was Thursday. Any surprises among the top half dozen or so picks?
You know, after the first two, everything's a surprise. I mean, I think the biggest news on draft night was the enormous amount of talent that the Oklahoma City Thunder got back in exchange for Serge Ibaka. They made a trade with Orlando. They got Victor Oladipo, who is absolutely going to have died and gone to heaven once he starts playing with Oklahoma City. That's enough to make him a five-year All-Star.
Major League Baseball Commissioner Rob Manfred said this week that he would consider Las Vegas when MLB Next expands. This could derail or at least postpone your plan to run the next expansion MLB franchise in Havana.
Yeah, this is again, you know, the man is keeping me down, Bill. What can I tell you?
He's got his foot on your neck.
Why? I'm like Tucker, the guy who invented that car that was squashed by the big three. But Las Vegas is, I mean, the NHL has opened the door
absolutely
to Las Vegas now because the Oakland Raiders are talking about possibly moving there. If MLB, you know, the cathedral of our sports, has decided to open a drive-through cathedral probably in Las Vegas, I think that the stigma attached to legalized gambling is pretty much gone.
Do you suppose the commissioner has checked to see what the average temperature is in Las Vegas during the baseball season?
Well, I think you can be fairly sure that whatever they build there is going to have a roof on it and air conditioning.
The most recent athlete to decide not to go to Rio in August because of the Zika virus is Rory McIlroy, one of Ireland's best hopes for gold. The Olympic Council of Ireland is, quote, extremely disappointed. I wonder if they have a lot of company or if nobody else really cares all that much about who plays golf in the Olympics.
Well, I don't think there ought to be golf in the Olympics. If nobody shows up to play, I'll be perfectly happy.
LeBron James, by the way, has also said that he's not going to these Olympics,
although
I don't know if the Zika virus has anything to do with that.
I like the fact that established stars in sports like basketball, you know, do their time, get their medal, and then don't play again. I mean, if it was up to me, I'd set a rule that you can only entitled to one goal. You win a gold medal, you're not
you don't
eligible
play on another
to
roster,
play again, right?
Jimmy
Butler from Chicago is going to get to go to the Olympics, which is a great thing.
I don't know who's going to win at Euro 2016, that marvelous European championship being held in France, but I believe the best fans there at those soccer championships are the fans from Ireland. I don't know if we have time to list all of their marvelous accomplishments, but pick a few.
Well, apparently one of the lads got a little bit overserved and put a dent in the roof of the car, somebody's car. And the other lads decided that this was completely against visiting soccer fan etiquette. So they pounded out the roof of the den with their hands.
They fixed it. And then they stuffed money through the windows of the car just in case there were repairs that were going to cost a little more.
While singing, "Fix the Car for the Boys in Green." And I'll tell you what, because I am also deeply, vastly, and perhaps irretrievably in love with the team from Iceland, if only because A, they're from Iceland, and B, their announcer is clearly insane, and three, because of a thing I'm following on Twitter called Reykjavik Grapevine, which is recasting the whole thing as a Nordic saga.
Of course.
If Ireland and Iceland don't play, just for the sheer joy of it, I'm going to be very disappointed.
You can find the sports writing of Charlie Pearson, Sports Illustrated, these days. And he joins me each week on Only a Game as well. Thanks, Charlie.
Thanks, Bill.
While many NBA analysts have turned their attentions toward this week's draft, commentator Mike Pesca isn't ready to move on just yet.
It's been a week, almost a week, since the Warriors lost to the Cavaliers in an amazing Game 7, and I've been still thinking about it in a way and for a longer time than I usually do after even an exciting championship game, and I think I know why. It's not just that the Cavaliers beat the best regular season basketball team in history. It's not just that LeBron James won his championship for Cleveland, a city which hadn't won in over 50 years. It's not that after games 1 and 2, the Warriors were up by a combined 48 points. It's all that plus a little bit how the media is constructed these days. I've been likening my intake of material about these games to how I view TV shows that I love, where I go to podcasts and I go to discussion groups and I check out the blogs. And for days and weeks after a fabulous series finale like Breaking Bad or The Sopranos, people aren't just reacting to it factually or emotionally. They're weighing in. They're being invested. They're talking about theories and legacies. And I'm thinking about the NBA championship that way. One of the things I've been focusing on is why Stephen Curry was so, for him, comparatively bad. And it is that he was injured. I know that the players have this construction where they say, I don't want to use an injury as an excuse. Yet if you looked at, there's an interesting statistic about uncontested three-pointers. Somehow, Steph Curry was allowed to shoot uncontested three-pointers. And during the regular season, he got more points out of uncontested three-pointers by far than anyone in the NBA. Yet in the postseason, I remember in the first round against Houston, he was hurt. He just got worse. He got worse when unguarded on these uncontested three-pointers. And I guess you could say that's psychology, but I really think it's injury. I also have to wonder about just my conception of the Warriors as this glorious, aesthetically pleasing team. When they're good and the shots are going in, they are. But you know, in Game 6, Steph Curry got mad and impetuous and threw his mouthpiece. And of course, Draymond Green, who has a lot of great things going for him, basketball and personality-wise, does have this tendency for his fist to meet the other player's groin area. And then in Game 7, Steph Curry, early in the game, turned to a referee and complained about a call he didn't get, didn't defend his man on defense. I mean, if anyone else did that, wouldn't we be calling the Warriors punks? The last way that I've been thinking about this series for a week is that up until Game 7, what we thought as basketball fans, was that there would be questions about the Cavaliers. We thought we would ask, would LeBron want to re-up and try to do it again? Can he ever get over the hump? Does LeBron as a GM bringing in the other players around him, will that necessarily doom LeBron's future as a player? Now there's an entirely new set of questions, and it concerns the Warriors, and they're equally fascinating. Will they eschew going for regular season records and bear down and win 2 championships in 3 years? Can Steph Curry, the unanimous MVP, can he be redeemed? Yeah, we're actually asking that. This NBA series contained multitudes, and I do not know how long it will take, if ever, until I'm over it.
Mike Pesca hosts the daily podcast, The Gist, from Slate. He's a panelist on the sports podcast, Hang Up and Listen, which posts every Monday. Don Newcomb pitched in the major leagues from 1949 until 1960, and on his best days, he was fearsome. Nuke, as he was known to his teammates on the Dodgers, won 17 games in his first season and was the National League Rookie of the Year. That year, he also became the first black pitcher to start a World Series game. 7 years later, he went 27-7, good enough for both the Cy Young Award and designation as the league's most valuable player. But 6 years after his retirement, Don Newcomb acknowledged what lots of people he'd played with and against already knew. He could have been a great deal better.
Newcomb could have been better if he'd been sober while he was playing.
Sarah Fields is associate professor in communication at the University of Colorado, Denver.
Newcomb himself thinks that he could have been in the Hall of Fame. And, I mean, he was a remarkable pitcher. But when he started pitching, he weighed about 225, 220. And when he finished, his weight had ballooned up to 250. He drank a lot.
Though that could be said of lots of major league players, there's no doubt that drinking diminished Newcomb's effectiveness and shortened his career. From 1958 until 1960, when his major league career ended, the former Cy Young winner bounced from team to team and lost more often than he won. Half a dozen years after retiring, he found recovery. Shortly thereafter, he started helping others along that road, and he helped begin Major League Baseball's program for alcoholics. Newcomb has often said he considers that work far more significant than anything he did on the mound. So when the February 14, 1994 Sports Illustrated swimsuit issue featured a pitcher who resembled Newcomb in an ad for Killian's Irish Red Beer, the man who'd found recovery and built his second career on counseling alcoholics was irate.
The ad itself is an interesting ad. It's got this picture of an African-American baseball player in mid-windup. There were some differences. He wore number 36 as a player. The number on the jersey was 39. The colors didn't quite match up to the Dodger colors. But the ad itself was an intentional play on the words of color. The text reads, most of all, and this text is just behind his image, most of all, it's been a game about color, where the grass is green and the ball is white and men in blue yell at guys named Whitey and Red, who wear hometown white pinstripes and away city grays. And in the stands, blue and white collared fans wave multicolored pennants, eating red hots and drinking red cold. Killian's Irish Red has the face of Irishman Casey with the town of Mudville. Then it talks about that it's a game of color, and I think this as I sip a cold Killian's Red, watching my team whitewash their rivals. Killian's Red, ask for it by color. But the image is of a guy who's the second African-American to play for the Brooklyn Dodgers.
More importantly, the image is of a guy who had dedicated almost three decades to helping those struggling with alcohol abuse. So what's Don Newcomb to do?
He's obviously frustrated, and it's America, so the best outlet for frustration is a lawsuit. I don't think it was about money for Newcomb at all. I think this was about protecting his image. Coors Brewing Company owned that particular beer. And so he files a lawsuit in the federal district courts, and he charges Coors with a violation of his right of publicity. The right of publicity is a relatively recent legal right. You know, if you go back to the 1920s when you first see signs in the U.S. of athletes being serious celebrities, Babe Ruth, for example, anybody who wanted to use his name or image could do so because he was a celebrity. It was assumed he didn't have control. You could use anybody's picture on any advertising, and that person really couldn't do anything about it.
Okay, but that was almost 100 years ago. This ad appeared in 1994. Surely athletes had the right to control their images by then.
At the trial court level, he loses. So Newcomb appeals to the Ninth Circuit of the United States Court of Appeals. And he argues that the Ninth Circuit should follow the lead of a judge who had dissented in a case called O'Brien versus Pap Sales from 1938. And that was actually a really similar case. Davey O'Brien had been this famous quarterback for Texas Christian University, and Pabst Brewery used his image on a calendar. A dissenting judge in that case in 1938 had said, you know, I think that celebrities particularly have the right to control their image so that they can profit off that.
But that wasn't the only precedent Newcomb could count on.
Another case that was had come in this chain of command was Kimbrough versus Coca-Cola. John Kimbrough had been a running back for Texas A&M, and he'd been told that he was going to be in the Texas Sports Hall of Fame, and they did a portrait of him. And so his daughter was appalled when she saw that same portrait in a Coca-Cola ad at a football game. O'Brien had been really angry about his image being used in a beer commercial because O'Brien didn't drink. whereas Kimbrough was angry about his picture being used in Coca-Cola because he wasn't being paid. The Newcomb case combines the two. Newcomb is genuinely most angry at being associated with beer, but he's got this Kimbrough case in the precedent to argue that it could also be about money. And his victory moves it forward. The courts essentially say it doesn't matter whether you agree with what you're being linked to, you have to agree to be linked to it.
But Newcomb's fight wasn't over. The appellate court had only ruled that he could take his case to trial.
If he could prove to a jury that Coors had used his image, that they had done so without his permission, that Coors had benefited financially, and that Newcomb had been injured in any way, then he could have received pretty significant financial damages.
So, did he benefit financially? Well, we don't know.
You know, there was radio silence after it was over, which makes me think that there was, in fact, a settlement, and that part of that settlement included a gag order prohibiting all parties from discussing it. I think for Newcomb, this was about proving that he was who he was. This is a man who saw himself as beating alcohol and alcoholism. And by proving that Coors hadn't duped him or conned him or paid him, his reputation and his dignity remained intact.
We don't know what, if anything, Newcomb gained from his lawsuit. He's 90 years old now. We asked for comment, but not surprisingly, we didn't hear back. But we do know that his fight against Coors had a huge impact on the rights of other athletes to control the use of their own images.
It was a step forward in the legal chain, so to speak, which allows an athlete to claim as much right and control over their image as athletes and celebrities do today. His influence and his effect on today's celebrity athletes is profound, and they all owe him a debt of gratitude and probably a thank you note.
Sarah Fields has written a book titled Game Faces, Sports Celebrity and the Laws of Reputation. Only a Game is produced by Karen Given and Martin Kessler. Our technical director is Marquise Neal. We had help this week from Alex Schroeder, and our intern is Ian Foster. Our senior producer is Gary Wallach. Our final word comes from Liverpool native and world championship boxer Tony Moran, who, despite not having a home of his own, has invited us to come visit.
You can come to Liverpool and I'll take you on the Beatles tour.
Well, I'm sort of a Stones guy, but hey, I accept the invitation. Can I visit when Liverpool's at Anfield? I'm Bill Littlefield. We return next week with more sports NPR style on Only a Game, and thank you for listening.